beaches are moving. Okay, now I'm getting into Montauk a little bit. This was taken, so let's see, we're a year out of initial construction on the geotextile bags out there. So yeah, this was either, I think prior to the, of course, prior to the construction, but this is what South Edison Street looked like. And that's a row of roughly 10 or 12 seasonal hotels. If you know downtown Montauk, I mean, it doesn't really have the elevation. And unfortunately, when we didn't have the insight roughly back in, I'll say, the 1960s, the primary dune, which is the larger, you know, the real beef of the dune system with elevation and substance, that was flattened to allow for ocean views. So they destroyed their primary dune in order to build these hotels. So you can see, of course, energy back to the dynamic equilibrium, narrowing beach. There's what's called a summer and winter profile. So again, relative to the beach itself, in the summer with calmer seas, calmer winds, you will have a buildup and accretion of beaches, the berm, which is the dry area of the beach. And then ultimately that material is moved toward the dune. A winter profile narrows, it becomes more steeper, as we're seeing here. So, you know, relative to, let's say, a July beach, there's, you know, probably 75 feet of dry beach that is, again, into the system, but temporarily lost to this particular beach. The response. In this case, in downtown Montauk, and this was Hurricane Sandy again. The federal government made available a great deal of funding. And ultimately, through our federal legislators, I believe at the time, Mr. Bishop, in responding to an erosion hotspot, you know, he was able to secure Sandy money as much as the Northeast. I mean, you'd get up into Brooklyn, Staten Island, all these locations. There was a great deal of federal money pouring into you know, the greater Northeast, particularly New York and New Jersey, to restore from the damages. So there was available funds. I had cautioned against any structures. Initially, the plan was for rock, so they wanted to build a rock revetment. They switched gears to sandbags, the geotextiles. I argue that they're one and the same. Don't go down that road. This is a little over half, 0.6 miles long in this particular reach of shoreline. So this is under construction. Sheep in wolf's clothing, a wolf in sheep's clothing, excuse me. This is post, back up. That's post-construction, and this would have been, I think, roughly February or March of this year. So this is probably a March photo in one of the nor'easters, Ocean Energy again. The narrowed beach, the sand over the top with the plantings, the snow fencing, all in a nice package. They put in, I believe, three or four walkovers. It used to be on grade. So they actually had the bridge up and over. Wolf in sheep's clothing, meaning it is what it is. It is a structure. And, you know, I bristle, and more recently bristled at the Army Corps when they had the meeting in Montauk on the Fire Island to Montauk Point plan roughly 2 weeks ago. They continue to resonate that they call it a reinforced dune. It's not a dune. Dune is a sand reservoir that comes and goes, and you know the processes take a while. You have structure under a veneer of sand. I pointed out to them that because of the depth, there's a roughly 3 feet of sand over the top of this. Now these are new plantings, American beach grass. They will drive down, and their network of roots runs very deep and very expansive. And ultimately, over time, when we've all seen natural dunes that are mature, you know, the coverage is, you know, it's dominant. But that network of sand provides some stability. Where we have geotextiles placed with sand over the top, the roots can only go down to 3 feet and they get stunted. So these plants never fully mature and never start to really dominate and do what they do best, and that's to stabilize sand dunes. The undressing, and this is a recent photo from Hermina, am I pronouncing that correctly? Which, by the way, I will say, again, this goes to my experience on the beach, amateur meteorologist. When that storm sat offshore, and it did for, 36 hours, and because of its location, we had predominantly offshore winds. And that surge was kept at bay because heavy winds, 40 mile hour plus, it pushes out the sea. And if you've ever seen that on heavy offshore wind days for a day or two, the bays are emptied out, and the high tide never really comes up very high because, again, that surge is going in the opposite direction. And that's what I believe in part saved this particular area from serious destruction. Had they been onshore for 36 hours and that piling of water with the wave energy, it would have been certainly more pronounced. But again, this is what is occurring in Montauk. There's been some minor recovery of the beach, but we are in the season of a winter profile, so I suspect one or two good nor'easters, if they're back-to-back in particular, or have a long duration where they're sitting out there just churning surf, we're going to see some real exposure and real problems. And again, back to the commons, the public trust doctrine, I feel, and again, not to sound cavalier, but the opposite, righteous. This is a public beach for access, and because of the impediment and the ability to have passage, that troubles me, and I hope it would trouble you. Swallowed Hole. This is North Topsail down in the Carolinas, and you can see the geotextile tubes. Basically strung along the condominiums. This on the lower part of the screen is actually the inlet, I guess North Topsail Inlet. But what we're not seeing, actually, you can pick it up here. This is all tidal marsh that wraps around the peninsula. And because of, again, structure, reflective wave energy, sea level rise, the equilibrium's affected, something has to give. Well, the shape of the beach is given. And for the life of me, and this is where the political courage comes in, Carolina elected officials, they've got to see the light here. And this, I'm sorry to say, this entire community, it has to move because there is no turning back here. And I want to point this out while we talk about structures, and this goes to the Army Corps plan as well. In components of their plan with the segments, it's not exclusively the ocean beaches. There are several communities on the back bayside, Southampton on Shinnecock Bay. Then you get further into Great South Bay. One in particular that I know, based on my field work, is Mastic Beach, which is at a low elevation just above sea level rise. And if you go down into that community, you can see the wetlands migrating, the tidal marsh is trying to move landward in conjunction with sea level rise. And what the prescription is that the Corps wants to spend, I think in whole, it was over $602 million for non-structural protection. And what that means is they wanted to elevate the homes, raise the roads, and then on the outer rim, so if you can picture this bayside, this would be a dike on the outer road that basically runs around this peninsula. Okay, there's some benefit. Of course, you're getting homes out of the ground, out of the water. We were pointing out, of course, what about the septic that's sitting in groundwater, polluting bay water? And the dike itself, while it will provide some protection with surge, so elevating seas and moving landward. What we have going on with sea level rise is inundation. So you have groundwater coming up vertically at the bottom. So as much as we may be controlling against surge and storms, you're not changing anything with regard to flooding. And some of the folks down there, and I've seen this in their yards, they are mowing spartina grasses, which is a wetland plant. That is their lawn grasses. And if they were left unaltered, you would see this vegetation coming up because it is converting to wetland from, we're talking, I think that's a 1940s community that was, based on, I believe the Brooklyn newspaper. If you bought a subscription back then, they'd sell you a small lot for pennies. Well, it's transformed into real neighborhoods now. And I am certainly calling on the Army Corps, and I hope they will heed this advice. It's better spent to buy out these homes as opposed to foolish structural remedies that will have no bearing on reality. Beach nourishment. This is actually a local project, and I call this slide Beach Folly. And I mean that because, again, this goes to my experience in South Florida. I've worked on roughly 6 large-scale beach nourishment projects in Palm Beach County. South Florida has been at the forefront of pumping beaches since the 1970s. Palm Beach, the town of Palm Beach. Of course, the county itself, Broward County, Miami-Dade. And I'm not suggesting this is something that you shouldn't be doing, but I'm sharing with you the realities of it. It's extremely costly, $15, $20, $40 million to pump, a couple of miles of beach. Going offshore, the sediments don't necessarily always match up with beach sand. Beach sand is unique to the dynamic equilibrium. So when you start going offshore, and in the case certainly of South Florida, they're getting into a different consistency of sand. Some of it's silt, very fine material. And I will tell you one project that I worked on, the biology, where we were trying to protect near shore reefs, and of course turtle habitat, and on. This was back then, I think, a $20 million project for a mile and a half. The material they claimed was beach compatible. And when they take these core samples offshore, to get an idea of what the deposit looks like, where they're gonna dredge from, in this instance, they were getting cobble, which were, stones, and silts. And then when you look at the mean grain size, if you average the two, and I'm simplifying this, then you end up with beach compatible sand. Well, when they pumped it, it was silt and then loaded with stone. And that beach unraveled in one winter season. I think it was 3 or 4, and these were not hurricanes. These were just nor'easters. These were just higher energy storms that caused that beach to disappear very quickly. And it became this, from county officials to the Army Corps, the blame game. But that's the reality of beach nourishment. The logistics of this. So we say, we have the money, we'll set up erosion control districts, we'll spend the $20 million to pump a beach. Well, you may have the money, but ultimately, as the demand is increasing, and up and down the East Coast, California, of course, and that's just our world, the United States, the demand for these large ocean-going dredges, they're in high demand. And right now, there's only a few companies that can do this type of work, that have the ships that are capable of it. And I submit that over time, when the demand increases, the availability of these dredges to line up for particular projects is going to get more difficult. And even back 20 years ago, or longer, with the project that I'm talking about, it was the Great Lakes Company. They're delayed 4 months because they had an emergency up in Delaware. And you think about it again. So, you know, here we had permits in hand, the funding in hand, and then we had to sit and wait 4 months for the dredge to be available. And that's only going to get more pronounced with time. Gray is the new white, right? The orange is the new black. So a little take off from there if you don't get it. quality of the sand. The Army Corps claims that we have high quality beach sediments offshore in these deposits that they've identified. You know, you ask them the questions. Yes, we've done the testing. And I'm describing to you personal experience where they did the testing and they were wrong. In this instance, you know, one can say, well, this will bleach out, which it will to some degree. But I can look at that. I can tell you that's fine material. Now we're getting into the muds somewhere offshore where this, and this is taken from the internet, not my photo. But ultimately, you know, the material is not native beach sand and very likely will disappear quite quickly. Again, cost, logistics. You know, what are we doing to the offshore with these borrow sites? The Quag Beach project, which was the DEC issued a permit, I guess, several months ago, two-mile-long project, 100 acres for basically the borrow site offshore. 100 acres in size, minus 7 feet in depth. So we're cutting a big hole in the ocean bottom. We're cutting that hole in the near shore. Extremely productive areas, you know, relative to the coast. Everything within our estuaries, you know, the bay waters, and then the near shore, that's where all the life is. And to carve out this hole, and then let's say you have a case of Jupiter Beach, oh shoot, you know, the material disappeared in 1 year. We got a hurricane or, you know, three nor'easters back to back. We got to come in another year. And the life expectancy, and this has been proven by the projects that certainly I'm familiar with and in reading the literature, is on the average about 5 to 7 years of life expectancy for nourished beaches. So in 5 years, we got to go out and carve another 100 acres. We're going to, you know, where are we taking from? Right next to it. And these depositional holes, and this is, I just saw a paper that was provided to me from one of the universities down in South Carolina, I believe. And they're actually looking at the productivity and the impacts of these borrow areas relative to biodiversity and productivity. And these are showing that the amount of life in these areas is depleted after these dredge cuts. And I see this all the time in bay waters, and it's apparently holding true for ocean waters. When you consider the bottom of a bay or ocean, and then you're carving out a hole, essentially. It could be rectangular, circular, whatever it may be, a dredge cut. The movement along the bottom, particularly with organics, seaweeds, you know, the eelgrasses, you know, all the organics, the dead life, you know, that over time is always swept across the bottoms in different directions based on currents. When you create these holes, they become sinks. So everything sloughs off into them. You get a buildup of organics, the plants, the animals. As they decompose, it's not sediments. And they become more anoxic or lack of oxygen. So in part, that's the reason for the lack of productivity. And that's why, at least in my work, I try to, certainly for navigable purposes, you know, we've got to be wary of dredging. Of course, we need it. But, you know, when we start going into expanding dredging into untouched shoals, you know, in the interest of building marinas, which I've addressed over the years, you know, you're basically opening the door for these dead zones in highly productive areas. So the level of organics, you know, they become dead zones. In some of the ponds, we've got to find a way to get them out back down to, native sediments, so you restore the productivity and the water quality within these areas. Sunny day flooding, and this goes to sea level rise. This is Dune Road. It's all parkland. Suffolk County owns this strand. This is just east of, west of Shinnecock Inlet, so the same quag stretch. You can see the primary dune on the left, and then we start to get into Phragmites through here, and then Spartina grasses. This is all Spartina right here. And the reason it's growing there is because coastal inundation. This wasn't rain. We had a week of dry weather. This is not a rain event. This is a new moon or full moon. I know the lunar cycle was more prominent, so it's going to raise the tides, and fresh water and saline water coming right up at the base. So again, with respect to certain areas where we have developed lazy points. I mean, I can go on with a list of communities or neighborhoods that, you know, because of their low-lying elevations, that they're going to be susceptible to sea level rise. The New York State, and I will share this when I finish this thought, it was probably 8 or 10 years ago, they started to embark on getting a handle on what sea level rise will look like, you know, in subsequent years and decades. Last November, they settled on projections, and this was a consortium of, multiple academic and scientific institutions where they kind of settled on, they all had the same projections. And I think in the 2050s, at the low end, we're looking at 16 inches, and the high end is 3 feet. And I just want to emphasize this on, you know, the elevation coming up in sea level, even several inches, you know, what that means vertically, oh, it's a couple of inches, what's the big deal? What that means horizontally is much more expansive. It, depending on elevation, it could be hundreds of feet. And it certainly, when you have saltwater intrusion, in other words, you have sea level coming up, it's a denser water column, it will underlie and come in as a wedge to freshwater, and it actually perches freshwater. And we deal with saltwater intrusion or saltwater coning. So these are real, environmental as well as human implications to sea level rise. And I certainly, in this instance, and elected officials do not want to hear me, but because we have minimal development out in this strand of Dune Road, I think it needs to be, we need to have retreat from that area and not continue with big investments. Good example, there's the old life-saving station, Tiana. You know, historical building. It's, you know, it's fabric of our community. There's probably a dozen of them, you know, up and down the East End. The town's talking about investing $1 million to restore the building. Well, we're in an area that in 25 years is likely have to be abandoned. So, you know, why make those investments? Why issue those building permits? Let's figure out how we can implement a buyout program to actually start to move out of that area. In the case of Tiana Life Saving Station, let's lift it up, move it over to the mainland in Hampton Bays and have a beautiful community center. But let's start to minimize and slowly eliminate strategic retreat the amount of infrastructure that we have in these vulnerable areas, because you could have the wall, you could have the wall of China on both sides, and you're not stopping sunny day flooding. And when you have homes that are sitting in groundwater, and I've watched some of the wetlands degrade because of, you know, there's a stretch of probably 5 or 6 homes that are just on the backside of the dune system. It was all wetland adjacent to them. They sunk these cesspools in the ground, septic systems. You know, the nitrogen flowing toward the bay is degraded and intoxified basically these salt marshes that are adjacent to these properties. And 15 years ago when this was being considered, I warned Southampton, I said, you're going to kill those wetlands. oh, no, we're not. No, we're not. You know, we've got the driveway away from it. We're not physically having our footprint on them. Well, guess what? They're, you know, basically nitrogen poisoned, you know, these tidal marshes that are now just mud flats. You know, and again, this is the, I think, the push, unfortunately, where there's development interest, you know, to keep pushing the edge. And again, what I'm trying to describe to you, we've got to get into a mode of thinking where we're pulling back. Adaptation. This is down in the Carolinas, and fuzzy photo off the net, but I'm trying to impress in your thinking that in some locations, you know, this is the intelligent choice is to move out of there. Raise that home, and granted, these are, you know, perhaps not the scale of some of our properties here, but nevertheless, you know, everything's movable. And I can tell you, I know who the movers are. They could move anything. I mean, if we're able to move lighthouses, you know, down in the Carolinas, and I mean, you know, if you've ever seen some of these pictures, putting these lighthouses on rails and just, you know, sliding them back, Cape Hatteras light, you know, some years back, we can move anything. And, you know, in this instance, you know, we are adapting because, you know, it in the long term, it's a losing prospect to think that we can define that line, the fluid line, that dynamic edge, and say we're going to stay there forever, because, you know, ultimately we will lose our beaches. And then that, again, back to the commons, just what they mean. I mean, I know certainly in my lifestyle how important, you know, the ability just to walk a beach, and of course, recreational activities. And if we end up with this armoring mindset where we, one wall at a time, a couple of groins, oh, we've got to put a wall in between them, you know, structural chaos, as I showed you. You know, we're going to rim our coast, bayside as well, oceanside, with walls in some form, geotextiles, sand tubes, sandbags, rock revetments, vertical sheet pile walls, steel, wood, doesn't matter. The armoring of the coast, inevitably we're going to lose that shoreline in front of it, and that's going to, again, affect ecology and certainly lifestyle. Resiliency. And back kind of full circle to the natural dune system, again, in Amagansett. Elasticity, and that the definition is the ability to kind of respond and spring back into a natural form. And I know, you know, in perhaps it's a little, no, it's not naive to think that, you know, we can revert to this. I think in some cases we have to. And back to Montauk, my recommendations and comments to the Army Corps and to the town, you know, we have to find the political will to remove, buy out those 10 or 12 seasonal hotels, extinguish the structures there, bring in a high volume of native beach sand, you know, if it means dredging offshore and beach nourishing in the interim, to restore functions and values of a natural system, that's where we need to go. And that will provide greater protection to certainly the downtown, while we're figuring out where we need to go with the downtown being, you know, again, you know, become an isthmus at some point. You know, these are hard choices, and that, you know, for me, when I advocate and speak to the science before our elected officials, unfortunately, they may grasp this and understand it, and I think I put it in a simple manner where you, hopefully you folks understand it. They're not thinking in terms of 25 years out or 50 years out in their decisions. It's more 2 and 4 year cycles, and we know what those are, you know, November 8. And, you know, unless they really break that shackle that they're in and start making decisions about Dune Road and downtown Montauk and the Mastic Beach. You know, when I challenged the Army Corps, I said, this is political. This is not science-based planning. They said, yeah, well, it is. You know, it's political because, again, you know, they're beholden to some elected officials that are telling them, you know, I can't affect my voting block down there. You know, they have also referred to some of these actions as band-aids. This came out of their mouths at these meetings. They've disclosed that in 30 years, they're no longer pumping sand unless, the federal government certainly tells them otherwise in 30 years' time. So that will lead us to our own devices. Are we setting up erosion control districts where we're taxing communities to pay for constant and chronic sand placement? Or are we going to start to think and make the choices that we start to, pull back off the coast? Resiliency, and that's resiliency right there. And I will tell you, again, as a beach aficionado all my life, and the amount of time and seeing the cycles, with on the beach every day, you see the storm, you see seasonal changes, you see the energy from one day to the next. Where there are natural systems, they're always there. Is this area, this hasn't moved too much. This winter, a couple of storms, Hermine, nothing. Beach changed some profile. 2 weeks later, back and wide again. All because of the system was intact, the beach dune system. And the Army Corps, they seem to talk about a reinforced dune, or, we'll pump beach and let's not worry about what happens on that transition zone, meaning the dunes. Well, without them, without no deposit, no return, then you are left with a system that is disjuncted, and ultimately then we'll be forced into these foolish actions. By foolish, I mean the walls, and then get into beach nourishment like we're hooked on drugs for forever. And one time out for $15-25 million, in a taxing district, let's say that, where, the back row is, and I know this because they're setting some of them up on the Peconic side, and homes that are literally, 1,500 feet away are being asked to pay for trucking in sand, and they're not happy about it. You may go along with it once, but if it disappears in a year or 3 years, and then you're back, okay, we got to hit you again with, thousands of dollars to contribute to pay for a $20 million project, I think your patience will run out pretty quickly. So back to resiliency and the decisions that bring us to that.